Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 1st, 2005. Today's session, Do You Really Mean Relationship? A Bible Study with Terence Fretheim in the Fireside Room. Disc number FRT 2005-01. Let's listen in.
Hosting this time together at 9 o'clock each of the weekday mornings. I'm Terry Fretheim. I teach Old Testament at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I will be beginning, what is it, my 39th year this fall. So, been there for a little while. Topic for the week is on creation, and I'm particularly interested in creation and relationship. And so today I'm going to talk, I'm going to be less into the Bible as such today, some, but and introducing the topic and the importance of relationship for our theological reflection or biblical reflection. For the next couple days, I'm going to work with the creation accounts and looking at them from a little different angle than perhaps you're used to from a relational perspective. For Thursday, I'm going to be looking at the book of Job, because one of the interesting things that happens in the book of Job is you get this deep problem of suffering. And then where does God take Job at the end of the book? God takes Job to Holden. So what has creation got to do with suffering? That's one of the nice questions that the book of Job raises for us. And then Friday we'll move more fully into issues of evil and suffering, particularly as related to creational considerations. Now, I had hoped that my book on this topic would have been out and available in the bookstore. It just came out a month ago, but this is the book which deals with this kind of material in much greater detail. It's entitled God and World in the Old Testament, A Relational Theology of Creation. It's published by Abingdon Press, and sorry that the bookstore doesn't have this, but I'll leave a copy here if any of you are interested in looking more closely at that. I think that the language of relationship is especially prominent among us these days for a whole variety of reasons. In every aspect of churchly speaking, of theological reflection, words such as relationship and relationality pepper our conversation. God's relationship with the world, your relationship with Jesus Christ. I mean, that language, that relational language, is there again and again. And I think that this language has been driven, intensified, if you will, by recent realities among us. Think of the internet and the interconnectedness of life that enables and reveals. Or think of 9/11, the interconnectedness of life there. I mean, 19 Middle Eastern men have deeply affected the life of each one of us. That's interrelatedness. Mm-hmm. There's an old play called, not so old, I guess, called 6 Degrees of Separation. You probably know about that, that every one of us are no more than 6 people removed from everyone else in the world. And it's down to 5, I think. And we're moving down, I think. Well, my question is, when we use the language of relationship, a relationship with God, do we really mean relationship? Do we really mean relationship? My own understandings of God in relationship are deeply affected by my own pietistic upbringing. Everyone has to say a word about themselves these days. That's the world in which we live. And I won't say much, but I was brought up at a parsonage, as was my father. Both my mother and father were reared in Norwegian pietism. Both of them were graduates of the Lutheran Bible Institute. But God is understood in highly relational terms. My parents used to herd all 4 of us boys, I was the oldest one, into the family room after dinner for family devotions. And every night. And the language of relationship, as I recall, seemed to be a part of that conversation in so many ways. My parents would pray and encourage us to pray as if God was upstairs and the walls were paper thin. And this is a relationship. This is a close relationship. It's an intimate relationship. I was raised in that from understanding of God and the God-human relationship. I didn't think as highly of it as I would move through it, as I might have. I think in many ways, since then, my whole scholarly life has been seeking to discern the extent to which that pietism connects with biblical material. I mean, did they get it right in any sense? So what you hear is sort of being built up off of that, that long experience. I'm interested also in the impact of our understanding of God, the God-world relationship, on the mission of the church. The issue of the attractiveness of God. How attractive is the God that you present to the world? Are people attracted by the God that you bring to them, the word that you bring to them about God? I'm convinced that one of the key stumbling blocks to the mission of the church in our world is is an understanding of God that's not very helpful in dealing with some of the more difficult issues of life. Oppressed people who are outside a religious community, oppressed people who don't show up, they belong to your church, but don't show up very much, or they've left the church for all practical purposes, oppress them. And I think it's, you probably will be surprised at the extent to which a certain imaging of God, a certain understanding of God, keeps them away, or keeps religious faith difficult for them. Martin Marty once told a story about an experience in a ski resort parking lot in Colorado, and it was a tragic moment where a young man was killed suddenly, and a clergy person was called and came to the scene and began talking with the parents and other members of the family about the event, and the clergy person said, "Someday you'll know what you did to cause this to happen." There's a lot of church language about God, a lot of traditional reflection about God that's not very helpful in such moments in life. What I call church-caused scar tissue. Maybe some of us have some of that scar tissue pretty close to hand. Others have deep scars that keeps them away. So that's another issue that informs my reflection. If you were to move out and about in your community, you'd have conversations about this God in whom you believe, I think you would be surprised at the extent to which the God language that you hear is characterized by extremes. On the one hand, God is sort of, and I find this increasingly the case as I get out and about in the church, God is the sort of the uninvolved overseer. God is sitting on the front porch of heaven watching the world go by. And I'll never forget, a couple years ago, I was in a Presbyterian church downtown Minneapolis, and a woman right there talking about these issues, and she said, "My God is an absentee landlord." Okay, why is that your image for God? Well, your calls are seldom returned and nothing much gets done. And she was deadly serious. Your calls are seldom returned and nothing much gets done. On the other hand, you get the other extreme where God is an absolute monarch, in total control of things, micromanaging the world. One of my colleagues, telling a story in chapel about returning from visiting an intern out in western Minnesota, and late Saturday night, came up behind the car, and the car was sort of weaving all over the road. Driver obviously had too much to drink. He came up close, and you know, do I pass? Do I just wait? And you know, whatever. Came up close, and there was a bumper sticker: "God is in control." Now, well, if God is in control, as we are wont to say, in one context or another, then given how unruly we all are, Wouldn't we have to score God a kind of crashing management failure? I think that the biblical material wants us to steer between those two extremes of the absentee landlord on the one hand and the micromanaging God on the other hand. And there's a road in between. The biblical material hasn't got a nice, neat place in the middle of that road, I think. Got a variety of texts with a variety of perspectives, but I think, generally speaking, it's going to keep us on that road if we attend to our texts. Another way of thinking about these images for God, thinking of extremes, is that you get God who is a distant God, radically transcendent, aloof, other, above and beyond the world. So, for example, every prayer is kind of like a roaming cell phone call that cuts in and out. That's sort of God's so distant. On the other hand, you get the other ditch, steering into the other ditch, that God's kind of a buddy-buddy, you know, never any critical stance here, no prophetic word, God's never in your face, you know, never has heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day kind of God. We sing only praise songs here. So there we are, extremes again. And we need to find our way somewhere. I think that the language of relationship can be of great help in enabling us to stay away from the ditches, stay on the road, and be truer to the biblical material about God and God's relationship with the world. Now let me just say, if relatedness, I want to say, relatedness is one of the most basic claims that the biblical material wants to make, and I'm coming particularly from the Old Testament now, the biblical material wants to make about God and about God and the world. And let me break that out into three points, if I might, very quickly. One is that God is a relational God in God's self. One of the very first words we hear in Genesis 1 is God creating the world, and then God says, let us create humankind. Let us. Who's the us? We're going to talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, but let's just say this, that God belongs to a divine community. God is not in heaven alone. God is a social being. Now, later Christian reflection is going to start talking about Trinity. Old Testament doesn't get there. New Testament barely gets there. But I think that that's an important claim that the biblical materials wants to make about God, that God is a relational God. We'll turn to that. Second is that this relational God has established a genuine relationship with the world, and particularly with the people of God, the chosen people, Israel, the Christian community later. And there's several ways in which one could observe this relationship that God has established with the world, with God's chosen people, both. Is if you were to take a look, say, at the metaphors, the images used for God in the Bible, it is striking that with few, if any, exceptions, these metaphors, this language for God, these images for God, are all relational. Think for a moment. Husband, wife, parent, child, teacher, student. Again and again, you get these images for God that are relational. If they're, they may be impersonal, God, say, related imaged as an animal or something, but they're still relational. Let's say Exodus 19, I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. I mean, an impersonal image, I suppose, and with that eagle image, but certainly deeply relational. It's these images for God are ordinary, everyday kind of language. I mean, parent, teacher, spouse. And they're concrete images rather than abstract images. Theologians are swimming against the biblical stream here with the use of important, I think, abstract language in one way or another. The language is everyday rather than dramatic. I mean, sir, there are dramatic moments in the life of a teacher or a parent or a spouse, but this is earthly language that's used to speak of God, not heavenly language. It's even secular language, not particularly religious language, that we use again and again to talk about God. So this earthy type of language for God, highly relational, relates God then to the world very closely, to everyday affairs, to our everyday lives. And this is thought to be a revealing of a God who has entered deeply into the life of the world and is present in our life together and not removed from that life. Now, the Bible is filled with neglected images for God or metaphors for God. And as we neglect these biblical metaphors, then we remove ourselves from all the relational talk in ways that is unfortunate. The book of Psalms, for example, has got over 50 metaphors or images for God. I remember preaching in at Zumbro Lutheran Church in Rochester, Minnesota several years ago. And I tried to develop a sermon building up off of Psalm 96. Sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. A new song. God is one who gives us new songs to sing. So I tried to develop the image of God as a musician. God is a musician. And try to work with how that might work in one situation or another. I was amazed after the service. I was standing at the door, shaking hands with folks, and person after person would say, I sing in the choir. I play the trombone. They were connecting, okay, these images of God with who they were, their everyday life in one way or another. And so it's the use then, the wide range of the use of biblical images for God that can make connections with people's actual lives and be of assistance, I think, in developing this relationship. A third way, so we've got a relational God. A relational God has established a relationship with the world, God's chosen people especially. And third, this relational God has created a world in which all creatures are interrelated. I think that biblical material will want to talk about the world as a spider web. Okay? That every entity in the world is in symbiotic relationship with every other. In such a way that any act, particularly if it's a human act, think of 9/11 again, will reverberate out and has the capacity to affect the web, send the whole web a shaking, if you will, in view of what's been done. So this interrelated world, interconnected world, is a very important dimension, I think, of biblical understandings. This stands over against any understanding of the world that is static or mechanistic. And we'll want to talk a little bit tomorrow about that God has not created the world as a finished product. We'll push that more tomorrow. But given the genuineness of these relationships now that God has established with the world and the kind of world that God has created, there's a certain degree of open-endedness in the created order, which makes room for novelty and surprise and randomness. You know, when you think of a spider web, there's all sorts of irregularities in a spider web, but the spider web works. Now, there are the great rhythms the biblical texts want to talk about. You know, Genesis 8, there's the seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night. But there's no little play in the system. And we'll want to take a look at the creation accounts in the book of Job to help us unpack that. Now, to think about the world that is so interrelated, so interconnected, to think about how God relates to such a world is complex. I think we speak very generally at this point, and we'll get more into it, that God honors this interrelatedness. God is committed to this kind of world. God acts from within a relationship with the world and not on the world from outside. God acts from within the relationship. So the Bible then encourages us, urges us, think of God as being in a genuine relationship with the world and intimately involved with every creature. And there comes our question, what do you mean when you use the language of relationship? Now, let me say a few things about this and then open it up and get your feedback. I think that we seldom take the word relationship seriously. If we do, we use it just loosely, just kind of, water off a duck's back kind of use of language. And when we use this language for God, our relationship with God, God's relationship with the world, I think that oftentimes there's a disconnect between our talk about God in relationship with the world and the way in which we use relationship talk with regard to our interhuman relationships. Your relationship with your spouse, with your children, with your friends. I think that the language of relationship as we use it in the everyday to refer to those close to us somehow when we understand what relationship means in those particular contexts, and then we use that language for God, and all of a sudden what happens commonly is that what is characteristic of our interhuman relationships no longer seems applicable in our talk about God. I think this becomes a key question. What if we took that word relationship, when used of God now, seriously, and thought of that more in terms of the kinds of relationships we have with one another? Remember now, the images used for God in the biblical material have to do with common everyday relationships, again and again, parent, child, spouses, and so forth. And as we make our way through this, one of the things I'd like to have you do is to think of a relationship that's very important to you, the most important one that you can imagine. And I'd like to have you think about what is characteristic, what are the essential characteristics of that relationship being real, of that relationship being genuine. Now, when we use the language of relationship with God, it's important to to hesitate here for just a minute. And remember that all language used for God is going to come up short. God's God and we're not. That means that the talk of relationship that we have and our, as we live and move among each other, is not going to be fully adequate in our talk about God. God outdistances all of our images. So we need to remember that. But at the same time, understand that the language of relationship can be very helpful. So when you might think of, with regard to every image that you use to think about God, you might think of a yes and a no. Yes, that's true about God. No, that's not true about God. So with regard to relationships, for example, we'll list some characteristics in just a minute, but one of the things you might say, well, one of the things that's not true in our common talk about every relationship about God is that God will always be faithful to a relationship, come what may. And that will be one characteristic of God in a relationship that is disconnected in some ways from the way in which we use the language of relationship among one another. There's a quote that Eberhard Jungmann, German, don't quote German systematic theologians very often, but this is one of them. He's got a book entitled God is the Mystery of the World. And he says, the more one understands God, the more mysterious God becomes. And the deeper one penetrates the mystery, the more interesting God becomes. That's one of the reasons why I work a lot with God stuff, because it's so interesting. In other words, the more you know about God, the more you know you don't know. And wouldn't it follow that the less you know about God, the less of a mystery God is? I think so. I think God's not demystified by further understanding, and greater, I think, indeed, the greater the understanding, the more God's inexhaustibility becomes apparent to us, that God outdistances all of our language. But I think one of the first things you're going to say when you get to heaven, and God starts talking, is you're going to say, "That's really interesting." I think so. But now let's talk about relationship. I'm going to give five characteristics of what I love. See if these five connect with, you know, you get your person now that you're working on. Okay. The person I'm thinking about is the person right over here in the front row, the one in the plaid slacks. We will have been married by the end of the week. We will have been married 49 years, folks. So I'm thinking relationship with this woman as I think about the relationship with God. Let's see how it works for you. Again, remember, the relationship with God is asymmetrical. One is that God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one who has something important to say. Are you listening? God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one who has something important to say. I find it astounding. I mean, we know that about interhuman relationships, that the other doesn't have something important to contribute to the relationship. What kind of relationship was that? Don't use the word relationship. No, we used to, talk about God? Well, we talk, but God's the only one who's got anything important to say. But then we forget, one of the basic gifts of God to us is prayer. The gift of prayer is so that we have something to say in this relationship. God so honors, so values the relationship that God gives us some say in the relationship. Now, if Moses is one of my favorites with regard to, I've been working on Abraham too, but these characters and their relationship with God don't just sort of sit back and take it all in. I mean, they're right there. What do you mean? What about this? What about this? And they're truly engaged in the relationship. God honors, God values what Moses has to say, and we would say God takes the relationship seriously. So, in some texts, you even get human beings talking to God. Exodus 32, for example, where God, remember the scene with the golden calf? Then God gets so ticked at the people, "I'm going to consume the whole lot of them. I'll start over with you, Moses, but I'm going to just wipe out the rest of them." And God, Moses enters into that conversation and says, "Well, let me give you some reasons why you ought not to do that." So you get Moses, saying, "Well, that wouldn't make any sense, God. I mean, you just gone to all the trouble of bringing these people out of the land of Egypt, and now you're going to turn around and do this?" Or, "God, remember you made some promises back there to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Are you going to be true to your promises or not? And God, what will the neighbors think if you do this?" what will the Egyptians say? I mean, they're concerned about attractiveness of God. What will the neighbors say if you bring to them a God like this? They're going to be turned off by the God you present to them. Then it says, Exodus 32:14, and God changed his mind about this in view of the conversation with Moses. Now, it's not that I think that Moses sort of had some better arguments here and than God, and God was saw that to be the case, but I think what it means is that God so honored the relationship with Moses that if Moses thought these things, that creates a new situation for God. And God now has a new situation with which to work and must move into the future in view of that, what Moses has had to say. So that's one. God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one who has something important to say. Second, God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one with something important to do and the power with which to do it. Now, again, just think about your relationship, my relationship. I mean, if she were the only one with power in the relationship, it would not have come close to 49 years. Okay. Really? I mean, what would it mean for a relationship if only one part of the relationship had all the power?
Or responsibility.
Or responsibility, something to do. Tasks. If you've got a relationship like that, don't use the word relationship for it. It's not at least it's not a real relationship or a genuine relationship if only one party has all the power. Or one party has all the responsibility. What's the first thing? We're going to see this tomorrow. First thing that God speaks to human beings when they are created. It would be interesting to see how we would have written that one. The very first thing that God says to the newly created human beings is, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, have dominion, subdue the earth. I'm giving you something to do, and I'm giving you the power with which to do it. That's the first thing on my agenda. Now, how seriously? I mean, that's what God immediately says. God takes this relationship seriously and understands that God cannot be the only one with power in this relationship. To put that in more positive terms, God chooses to entrust us with responsibilities. It's not only that we are to place our trust in God, God also places trust in us. A third characteristic is that God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one whose will is important. We speak rather glibly at times about the will of God, as if whatever God wills, God gets done. And so we got all these sins that are being committed day after day after day. And is that the will of God? Remember what it means to be in relationship. That the other in the relationship has a will that counts. A will that's effective. And so biblical material again and again is going to say that God's will is resistible by the human will. If you take the Ten Commandments, I mean, this is the will of God, right? Love your father, honor your father and your mother, don't kill, don't steal, etc. And sin, the breaking of the commandments then, is resisting the will of God for our life together. God honors this relationship. God understands that what people will counts, and even though that the exercise of that will may mean for considerable havoc wreaked in one situation or another. If God's will always got done, why is it that in the Old Testament alone, God gets angry over 500 times? Why would God ever get angry if God's will always got done? Remember Jesus' words over Jerusalem. How often would I have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings? But you wouldn't. You wouldn't. Now, we'll come back to some of these themes. The fourth, God so enters into relationship that God is deeply affected by what happens to the relationship. What kind of relationship would it be if God were just simply so removed, was unaffected, that a tear never shone on God's face? It's very interesting. One of the very first images of God that we get in Genesis is the image before the story of the flood. There you get a God who enters into judgment, but you get the repeated language of it grieved him to his heart. And so God is affected by what happens to the rest. Just think of, again, think of the relationship with the person close to you. What would it be if the other were never affected by what happened to the relationship? What kind of relationship would that be? Now, one of the ways of thinking about relationships here in this context, just quickly, with that we think about relationships as constant and changing. And I think we also need to think about the relationship with God, too, as constant and changing. Constant, in, again, thinking of the other person with whom you're in relationship, you want to talk about sort of commitment, faithfulness, staying in there through thick and thin with one another. There's a kind of a constancy there. On the other hand, there's change. I mean, if I haven't changed over the years, we wouldn't be here. So God's character is never going to change. I mean, you can count on God's love for you. You can't stop God from loving you. Good luck. God's going to be faithful to promises made to you. Count on it. God will not be unfaithful. God will be committed to this relationship. God's love for you will never end. But there's going to be some, God's going to change too, in view of the changes in your life, the changes in your world. And that's going to mean some change too. In order for God to keep up with you, God's got to be on the move too. So that becomes a fourth. A fifth understanding here is that some of the ways in which you could talk about God being on the move. God's response to Moses, for example, in that argument over the golden calf, that would be an instance of God sort of moving in view of new times and places. One could take a look at the law and say, okay, you got the Old Testament law moving through time and space, and so what happens to the law in view of new times and places? As we understand, God initially gave the law, and now what does God do with it in view of those new dimensions of the relationship? A fifth and final here, and then we open it up, is that God so enters into relationships that the future is not all blocked out or mapped out. That the future is at least somewhat open, even for God. I want to read a text as a way of introducing this theme. It's kind of an out-of-the-way text, but it's helpful, not least in, given the context in which we are. From Jeremiah 22. Thus says the Lord, go down to the house of the king of Judah, and speak there this word, and say, hear the word of the Lord, O king of Judah, sitting on the throne of David, you and your servants and your people who enter these gates. Thus says the Lord, act with justice and righteousness, and deliver from the hand of the oppressor anyone who has been robbed. And do no wrong or violence to the alien, the orphan, and the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place. For if, now that's really, why would God ever need to say if? This is going to come. You got one handy, Chris?
Right there.
Right there. There it is. Okay, good. So, do justice. We could also say, take care of the environment. Okay, that's the word from the Lord. God says, if you do, let's see, what does it say? Verse 4, for if you will indeed obey this word, then through the gates of this house shall enter kings who sit on the throne of David, riding in chariots and on horses, they and their servants and their people. Okay? If you do, then this is going to be your future. I'm going to do this. Okay? Then verse 5. But if you will not heed these words, I swear by myself, says the Lord, that this house will become a desolation. Okay? God says, if not, then this is going to be your future. So here's the word from God. And God sets up that word and outlines two possible futures. If you do, or if you don't. Now, one of the interesting things is that if you do, then God's going to do one thing. If you don't, God's going to do something else. So that means that how you respond to this particular word affects not only your future, it affects God's future. Now, what people do counts not only for the sake for the future into which we move, the next day, the next week, the next years, it makes a difference to the future of God. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. That's somewhat open, okay? Future is. There'll be a new heaven and a new earth. But between now and then, various courses of action are available which will help shape that time between the now and then. And if one thinks of the new heaven and the new earth as a quilt, and you're going to have a patch in that quilt, the kind of patch you create will affect even the shape of the new heaven and the new earth. Now, sometimes an unqualified language about the future, thinking about relationship again. Well, the future's in God's hands. I think that that is a problematic statement. I think it can lead to people saying, well, what kind of relationship with this is if the future is entirely in God's hands? If we say the future is ultimately in God's hands, okay. Ultimately in God's hands. But if we just say the future is in God's hands, people can easily conclude that it doesn't make any difference what we do. You know, it's out of matters of justice or matters of environment. Doesn't make any difference. God's got the future all mapped out, and what we do is finally irrelevant. Remember Jesus, the temptation of Jesus? The devil took him up on top of the pinnacle of the temple to jump off. Jump off. God, are you going to trust God or not? What do you jump off? God's going to come down and rescue you just before you hit the rocks below. Are you going to trust God or not? Are you going to put your future in God's hands, Jesus, or not? And Jesus says, in effect, that's not faith, that's fate. You shall not tempt the Lord your God. And my grandpa was a pastor, and he put his whole self into his whole future into the hands of God. And he died before he showed up with colon cancer, because he said, God will take care of the blood in my stool. And he ignored the symptoms, refused to see the doctor until he was dragged there. Because his future, he placed his future in God's hands. I think that sometimes can happen to relationships, is that we just sort of give it all over to God and don't take responsibility for these dimensions of the relationship which God has given to us. We have something to say. We have something to do. We have the power with which to do it. We have a will that counts. We are affected by one another in this relationship, and that future is ultimately in God's hands, is not fully mapped out. Let's talk about this a little bit. What do you think? You got some other, with those five dimensions of relationships, you got some others that might be helpful here? I just would have a nice list of 10 to give to people rather than five. But if you're, yes, please.
I was thinking, as you were going along, the first word that comes to me in any relationship, it's not going to go 49 years or R53 without communication.
Yeah.
Constant communication. And yep. I think that goes along with God, too.
I think that's very, basically, I should have used the word communication, too, in that first point. God is not the only one who has something important to say.
Well,
The communication goes both ways, for sure. Yes, indeed. I think that's absolutely crucial. Congratulations on your 53. That's wonderful. Yeah. Oh, was there a hand over here someplace? Anyone else? Yes, please.
I think that this may not be one of the five, but it's a kind of a ground for it. And that is, there's an assumption or a dedication to being authentic in this relationship and not to extract things from it that aren't known or clear, that there's that kind of intentionality in the relationship. You may have already covered it, but there are relationships where you don't commit to being as clear, as authentic, as above board, and simply use people.
Right.
It's still a kind of relationship.
Yeah. The integrity in the relationship, authenticity in the relationship, I think that's a very important language. And I think When I use the language of God honoring the relationship, God being committed to the relationship, I would want to make sure that authenticity, integrity language got in there. I think sometimes maybe that's not lifted up as sufficiently as we might well do in thinking about God's relationship with us. What does it mean for God to be truly committed to a relationship and to be authentic in that? I think we sometimes think, "Oh, God can do whatever God wants to do." Well, can God be unfaithful? Can God be not authentic? There's some issues there with him, and it's not easy. And we need to kind of begin to break that out some. But wait a minute, yes.
Yeah, this you may have addressed this too in some way, but the fact that in a relationship, each person needs to be able to and to be given and supported in growth and sort of developing to the fullest who they are.
Yeah, that's very nice. And so it's support of the others. I've got some. I got to write that down so I don't look at that. I think there are, if we want to talk about a genuine relationship between two human beings, the consequence, we would want to make sure that a characteristic of that was a deep concern for the other's personal development, growth. That's important. Indeed, thank you for that. Yes, please.
42 years. In my wife's relationship with me, there has to have been a lot of forgiveness. Now, does that enter into one of your categories? Do I have to forgive God sometimes? I'm not quite sure what to do with that, but that's a pretty important.
It sure is. I don't know. Have you had?
I remember being very well trained by you early in our marriage. Faith, just learn to say you're sorry. It didn't come easy.
Yeah, there's a host of issues that helpful comment raises, for example. What of what importance is repentance, for example, relative to forgiveness? The readiness to be there with forgiveness again and again and again, that would be what you're lifting up, it seems to me. But I agree. I think that's absolutely crucial for the ongoingness of a relationship of consequence.
Love means often having to say you're sorry.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's trivialized oftentimes in some of the contexts in which that phrase is used. But I think that there's a, and it can be that, trivialized, but I think that there's some real heart and soul to that way of putting things. Right there.
I was going to speak to the timeliness of our relationship with God, illustrated by your relationship with your wife and that of each of us with our spouses. When you were first married, I imagine you thought you'd never make it to 50 years. Because it was a death-defying experience to get that old. Whereas today, it's not uncommon for folks to approach or be near just past their 50th anniversary.
Yep.
It was in my understanding of my grandparents' lives that it was pretty rare to get to 50.
Right.
And nowadays when people enter in, like I met a couple over here that are married 2 years, and they can look forward to maybe celebrating their 60th, 70th. The relationship holds and develops and mixes, and God's relationship to us as a humankind situation is never ending.
Yeah.
And his concept of the relationship is consequently different than ours when we're expecting to live to be whatever age we expect to live to be.
That's good.
And so that's why I look at this and I think his alternatives can be thought of differently from his point of view than our point of view.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's one of the points at which, or God's perspective within the relationship has the depth and breadth and a range that ours does not. And given the years that are more possible these days than typically was the case in the past, how that relationship is handled over the years, how one works with one another within relationship becomes all that more important, it seemed to me. But, yeah, thanks for that comment. There was a question here over here. Yes, please.
Faith and presence. You know, I'm thinking of like the poem of the footprints in the sand. As you're going through life and there's only one set of footprints, and that sense of God's presence and being there even when we don't sense it, and it's our faith that makes it real. And then as you've talked today, it's kind of made me think of God's sense of that. Where are my footprints when he's walking, you know?
Yeah.
And his sense of faith that somewhere mine or my partner's, you know, is going to be there.
Right. That brings up an interesting theological issue. There are different sort of Lutheran perspectives on matters of that sort, and sometimes they're characterized as cat theology or monkey theology. Cat theology is, okay, you've got only one set of footprints. Are you holding on, or is God holding on to you?
Yeah.
There's a different way in which one thinks about that can affect one's larger reflections on that. It's helpful. Yeah. Way back there. Thank you.
I can go back to your comment on communicating, which the lady in front of me shared. God is not dead, but he sure doesn't seem awfully quiet. How do you feel, and go a little further, how does he communicate back? We talk to him in prayer.
That's good. I think that there are a whole variety of ways in which God communicates to us. And most of the time the problem is with our listening and our discerning, and not God speaking. God uses other people to speak or get through to us commonly. Okay, that's one common means. Are we listening? Are we hearing a particular word from a friend or a spouse or whatever as God's word to us? It's God's way of getting through to us. Pay attention to your dreams. God works, I mean, biblical materials, both old and new, but God speaks in and through dreams. I mean, I worry about discernment here. I worry about interpretation. The problem with interpretation, I've not cut off that as a vehicle in and through which God can get through to us. So, I mean, I think I think the problem is more commonly our listening or our discerning than God speaking. I think it's possible that God may not speak. They might sort of go silent on us. I mean, I think in a relationship of consequence, do things ever go silent from here? For good reasons. Well, I think I will worry about sort of giving God the silent treatment by never praying, but I think that I think there is some room for silence in a relationship, and God knows how effectively to use silence. Yeah. Mark.
I think this raises a very interesting point. I was thinking about sort of public and communal aspects of relationship. That my relationship with Catherine is not solely private. There's an extended family. There are children. There are friends, all of whom contribute and are part of that relationship. And you know, in terms of communication, all of whom help those the things that need to be said and acted on and done help make that happen. And I think about the public nature of, say, the marriage ceremony or the commitment ceremony. That it's not an isolated relationship. It's a relationship that's part of that spider web that you talked about.
Right. You've just heard from the village philosopher. And the bell rings. And that means that we're supposed to cut it off. They're pretty. What, one more, maybe?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
I was just going to go back to partially to the forgiveness thing, because we think in terms of God forgiving us, but sometimes we need to forgive God, in that God's response is not what we wanted, and that makes us angry. You know, I mean, I'm mad at God half the time. but God does not always move the way we want, and we need to be able to forgive God. I think forgiveness is a two-way street, and we don't talk about that. But the other thing I wanted to add to your list was that we need to be accepting of others' limitations in a relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know my husband is certainly very accepting of my limitations, and I try on his part. But God, I think, limits himself and herself in a variety of ways, one of which is to give us free will. Mm-hmm. And we have to accept that limitation, that God is not necessarily going to come down and tell you just exactly what to do.
Okay, well, there are about 17 good handles to get a hold of on that comment. Thank you very much, and I think we should honor the time. Thank you.